is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
But I don't necessarily have to go to the disaster zones because I can see climate-driven changes right in my own garden. We've got certain birds and bugs that are gone. The fruit trees are no longer reliable. You're working on a new book about a really local climate vision. Do you want to give us a sneak peek?
In March, I will have a new book. It's called The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, a story of climate and hope on One American Street. I live right on the border of Washington, D.C. in Maryland. It's an old trolley suburb, 100-year-old home. And we have seen a fantastic loss of our biggest trees in the last 5 years alone. It's just really accelerated. We've lost red and white oaks especially. It's not me saying it's climate change that's killing the trees. It's the city arborists and the regional environmental policymakers are counting more and more deceased trees. So the book is about how, you know, we no longer have to travel to the Great Barrier Reef or to the Arctic poles to see climate change. It's now happening, as you mentioned, in your own garden. And what I do in this book, for 1 year in 2023, I keep a record for 12 months of what I've seen are plausible impacts of climate change. And that is, Lyme disease is so rampant in my neighborhood. I myself suffer from persistent Lyme disease picked up from a tick in my backyard. The winters don't kill off our ticks the way they used to. The trees are receding and flooding. My church, which is a block from my house, we can't keep water out of our preschool basement. So it's a story about how climate change has reached a point where you could take a dart and throw it at a spinning lacquered globe, and wherever that dart lands now, you can write a whole book about that one little micro dot. And the reason I know that is because I've done it on my one block. And it's meant to be, you know, it's here, let's recognize the changes that are happening out our front door, and let's push even harder for clean energy solutions.
I'm looking forward to reading that. I think that's up my alley. Okay, now your previous book, your 2012 book, The Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities, was part of the title. And part of that is the insurance crisis you just mentioned. It turns out a lot of Florida properties were just not insured, and I don't know where that goes next. Maybe a federal bailout or maybe a lot of homeless people. And it costs a lot more to rebuild after inflation. But after a series of super disasters, you know, from Houston to Tampa, surely some people will realize it is time to retreat from the rising sea. Is that time coming for America, or can we just put it off forever?
No, we can't put it off. I do believe. I was just in Louisiana last year for the first time in a number of years, and I was stunned by how it didn't matter what your economic status was. If you had a small house in the wetland grasses or a fine home in the French Quarter of New Orleans, everybody was being hammered by rising homeowners insurance, and people were negotiating with their insurance companies. Well, if I cut half the benefits, then my insurance rates will only increase 40%. And so people are getting less of their value covered in the insurance, and they're paying exceptionally more for it. And that's just utterly unsustainable, again, for everyone, not just for the poor and middle class, but also for wealthier homeowners. I feel like insurance is that one thing that we can't deny beyond a certain level. I don't know how you have an economy without insured assets. I do believe it's going to reach a point where it's not a matter of fancy homes and only the wealthiest can have homes along waterways. It's when entire communities in places like California and Louisiana and Florida just can't afford to insure their homes, and inevitably with climate change, those homes are going to be damaged or destroyed, as we've seen in Western North Carolina. We'll see. I think Western North Carolina, where 99% of the homes did not have flood insurance, what does a flood this widespread do for migration and communities' ability to rebuild? Those abilities are finite, and I do think that insurance is going to be that one issue that we can't keep putting off. And again, hopefully will engender greater interest in trying to figure out what's causing these disasters and what can we do to be more resilient, but hopefully reduce the greenhouse gas emissions as quickly as we can so that they don't become even more fierce.
Do you think the hurricanes will eventually push more people into climate activism?
I don't know. I think they're going to push more people into continental interior areas. I think that's inevitable. We saw that with Katrina. There was permanent migration away from South Louisiana. I keep hoping, Alex, that there will be a wake-up call. We've all seen, you know, we thought Katrina was going to be a wake-up call. We thought the heat wave deaths in Europe in 2003 would be a wake-up call. And it just still feels like we're not awake. You know, you had a guest on, the Greek economist who wrote the excellent book Beyond the Petri Dish, which I just read, where he called it the Great Silence. You know, we're living in an era of the Great Silence on climate change to our detriment. I don't know. He does argue there that we seem to struggle to hold climate change in our minds long enough to do something about it, but our bodies will certainly move us to action if and when we become food insecure. I hope that that's not what it takes, but I have been surprised, honestly, in 22 years as a climate activist, I've been surprised at how we do make movement every time there's a disaster. We do have more awareness of climate and more political will, but not at the level that one would expect rational communities to have.
Well, that's a harsh note to leave it on. Let me ask you this final question. What is the Chesapeake Climate Action Network up to these days? Actually, when I check out your blog, I see more solutions.
Yes, there are a ton of solutions. We are fighting for clean energy throughout the region of Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. We occupy and surround the nation's capital. I will tell you from my seventh floor office right on the border with D.C., it's very interesting to see how we pass a new solar law in Maryland, and then on the rooftops of the buildings around us, we then start to see more solar on rooftops. We pass a law mandating that new buildings in the District of Columbia be all electric. And then within a year or two, we start to see new apartment buildings with heat pumps on the roofs. So we can actually look out across this region from our high-rise office building and see the results of our policies all around us in physical terms, which is very gratifying. We're winning the battle for clean energy. There's no doubt about that. In my community of Tacoma Park, the first gas station in the world, as far as I know, that converted entirely from gasoline to charging electric cars is right here in my neighborhood. So instead of buying Citgo gas from Texas, you now get electricity from solar farms across the region put right into your car. So we are making progress, no doubt about that. The great activist Bill McKibben said, you know, winning slowly can be the same thing as losing. So we gotta win faster, and obviously this upcoming election in the United States will have a lot to do with that, and I'm optimistic about that election as well.
From Washington, D.C., our guest is Mike Tidwell. Watch for his new book in the spring of 2025. I'll be keeping my eye out. Find Mike and his passion at ChesapeakeClimate.org, or you can use links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Mike, good to hear from you, and thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock reporting. I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
After the megastorms, wildfires, floods, and killer heat around the world, this November, all countries will meet in Baku, Azerbaijan, to discuss what to do. They have a myth to sell you. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change offers a kind of free pass. If humans push past the 1.5 degree safety line, maybe that is okay. Future technology will bring carbon back down again, cooling the Earth. Do you believe that? The best analysis from European scientists do not. The new paper in the journal Nature is called Overconfidence in Climate Overshoot. We reached Dr. James Dyke, Associate Professor in Earth System Science at the University of Exeter. James is Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute. He publishes widely in newspapers and online. Dyke's latest book is Firestorm and Flood, The Violence of Climate Change. From the UK, James Dyke, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
What is the theory of overshoot in climate?
The idea of overshoot is both remarkably simple and very worrying. It's remarkably simple because it essentially says, if we set a target, or let's say a threshold for any amount of warming, it could be 1.5 degrees Celsius, 1.6, 2 degrees, whatever it is, in principle, we should be able to lower global temperatures back down to that amount. So at the moment, we are about to breach the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming threshold. And the overshoot argument essentially says, don't worry too much, because by deploying carbon dioxide removal, we can suck CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere, and just as increasing emissions made temperatures go up, while then decreasing emissions along with carbon dioxide removal will make temperatures go back down. Now, it's worrying because at the moment we have no real capability to do that. Over 99% of all current carbon dioxide removal technologies are essentially forests and trees, or maybe mangroves, what we call nature-based solutions. Our abilities to deploy machines or technologies to augment that is extremely limited. And when you look at the past track record of these technologies, how we've tried in the past to capture and store carbon dioxide at any significant scale, then I would say you have no confidence these technologies are actually going to scale up at the rate at which we need them now.
And we're dealing with living systems. I mean, anyone who watches nature knows once things change, they may never go back. Here in Canada, when Atlantic cod were fished almost to extinction, they did not return after fishing was stopped. Other life forms took over that ocean bottom habitat. So you multiply this a million times for bacteria and plants and animals. How could anyone believe humans can just wind back a clock of living systems to what they were?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Some people have made the case that our increasing reliance on carbon dioxide removal in this context of overshoot is a little like implying that we've got some kind of time machine that we can wind back the clock on essentially decades of delay to actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But it's not a reversible system, right? I mean, the recent research, and this, I think there's now quite abundant research, and there's always been a lot of reasons to think that what goes up isn't simply going to come back down. A lot of my research and interest around these things called tipping points in the climate system, and when it's either the potential collapse of ocean currents or the disintegration of ice sheets or the dieback of the Amazon forest, once those dynamics start, they are going to be extremely hard, if not effectively impossible, to reverse. And so the greatest risk with exceeding 1.5, or even where we are with current amounts of warming, is that we could transgress these kinds of thresholds. So even if we do somehow manage to get temperatures back down, in some respects, it will be too late, because further amplifying effects and interactions in the climate system means that we are on a course to a much more different, potentially more turbulent and dangerous climate.
And why would the Overshoot Overconfidence group focus on what they call regional climate change reversibility? I'm not sure what that means.
One way to think about our concerns about the climate is not that we're particularly worried about the global average temperature. I can appreciate that sometimes people might think it's very odd for climate scientists to obsess over whether we are at 1.2 or 1.3 degrees Celsius. But those global changes are masking very, very large regional differences. And the reason we care about climate change is because it's going to affect the weather. It's going to affect what happens in your neighborhood or in your country, in your region. And so if you're a farmer, you are highly attuned to these kind of changes in climate, because you know when the rains are later than they were previously. You know when the rains become more intense, such that you can't plant certain crops and you can't harvest them when you would. And from a human healthcare perspective, we are worried about not average changes in temperature, but periods of intense heat waves. I mean, we have heat waves which have killed tens of thousands of people in Europe, one of the richest places on Earth, because there are adaptive limits. We can only adapt so much and so fast to climate change. So when you're looking at changes in the global climate, we should really be concerned about what's going on within regions, what's happening in terms of places over particular periods of time. And when you do this kind of analysis of basically the modelling of increasing temperatures and then trying to drag it back down through global carbon dioxide removal, you begin to see that in some of these regions, whilst the global temperature may be back down, the region's climate, the region's weather, what's going on there in terms of not just the weather, but also what's living there, those ecosystems, those habitats, those things have fundamentally changed, and they may be changed for good.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change AR6 process, that's the latest one. It's not very concrete about overshoot. They talk about going 0.1 degrees C over the safety limit, or it could be 0.3 C or more. In our May 2022 interview, you were the one who told us every tenth of a degree matters now. Should we be nervous about this fuzzy math and the permission to fail, how it's developed in official channels?
We should be really worried about uncertainties in the climate system. I mean, even if we had perfect understanding of what's going to happen and the timescales of which it's going to unfold, there's already abundant evidence that we are already in an awful lot of danger. I mean, we can just see the extraordinary situation. We've got two hurricanes impacting the same region in the United States, separated by a couple of weeks. And this is not surprising. You know, climate scientists have been talking about these sorts of things for decades. It's one of the reasons why we're concerned about climate change. When it comes to this notion of every degree matters, the simple and kind of brutal reality is that the warmer that we make the world, the more energy that's in the climate system, the more dangerous that climate system becomes, the more loss and damages, the more suffering and the more deaths. And in some respects, that's a progressive kind of response. The more warming, the worse it gets. When it comes to tipping points, but then also these other potential kind of abrupt changes, we could see potentially devastating, in some regions, potentially catastrophic impacts. And that doesn't mean they're bound to occur at 1.5 or 1.6 or any amount of warming. What it means is the warmer that we make the Earth's climate, the more energy that's in the system, we're kind of increasingly loading the dice for these potentially catastrophic events. So there's kind of two things that we need to hold on to. One, we might be lucky, but we also might be unlucky. And any sensible risk assessment means we should always prioritize the potentially catastrophic events and do whatever we can to avoid them. And two, this notion of, yes, progressive warming, it gets progressively worse, progressively warming, progressively worse. But there could be things that come at a complete surprise, which could have these potentially catastrophic impacts.
Let's get to the official solution on offer, carbon dioxide removal, or CDR. Can you give us an example of the technology proposed for this?
The CDR is not a new idea, and it certainly even predates the 2015 Paris Agreement. But the Paris Agreement is a good place to start, because when you look at the text, when you look at what countries actually agreed to, nowhere does it mention fossil fuels. It doesn't actually mention coal or and gas, and it certainly doesn't mention phasing them out. What it talks about is the sources and sinks of carbon dioxide with regards to temperatures by the end of the century. And so the Paris Agreement basically says that the international community will stabilize the source of carbon dioxide, well, that's from the burning of fossil fuels, also importantly, land use change in agriculture, along with the sinks. Now, the sinks are initially what we call natural carbon sinks. So something like nearly half of all the carbon dioxide that humans produce today ends up in the land sinks, so for example, forests and trees and soils, or the ocean. The ocean absorbs carbon dioxide just through essentially chemical processes, but then there's also an important kind of biological amplification of that as well. So when they were thinking about how on earth are we going to limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, well, you might naively think that that would mean a rapid phase-out of fossil fuels. But that's not what's happened. Really, politicians have proposed that we can essentially carry on with fossil fuels, and today emissions are actually higher, significantly higher than they were in 2015. And what we'll do is spin up the sinks. Basically, if you imagine the bathtub analogy, where it's kind of water or carbon dioxide is flowing in, if you want to lower the level of that bath, if you want to lower amounts of concentrations or lower the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, then you just need to increase the flow out. So we could plant more trees, we could do reforestation or afforestation, and certainly we do need more trees. But it's become increasingly realized that that's not going to be enough. You can only plant so many trees. They can only grow so fast. And so there's increasing interest in much higher tech approaches. And of those, probably direct air capture has gotten the most interest at the moment. And you can think of that as these sort of massive air conditioning systems that will suck out carbon dioxide directly from the air, concentrate it, then pipe it and store it and ship it, and then pump it deep underground in probably depleted oil and gas wells. And then through that process, what humanity is essentially doing is increasing the flow of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and putting it in the ground where it came from in the first place, because the carbon was emitted from fossil fuels that have been in the rocks for many tens or if not hundreds of millions of years.
According to the Global CCS Institute, there are 41 CDR projects in operation and 351 in development worldwide. James, how close do you think we are to capturing the amount of carbon dioxide we need to remove from the atmosphere, say to get back one of those 0.1 degrees of overshoot?
This is the, I would call it, you know, the $6 million question, but it's not really. It's the multi-billion dollar question, because there is a tremendous flow of finance into approaches to remove carbon dioxide removal. We're currently working on a report at the moment, and we've discovered over 1,300 different companies that are proposing in some way, shape or form to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So that could be through direct air capture, but there is, I mean, if you can imagine a way to remove carbon dioxide, there is some company that is proposing it, and there is an increasing amount of finance. I mean, the leading direct air capture company, Climeworks, has now received private funding of over $1 billion. And that is in response to its abilities, its current abilities, to remove a very, very modest amount of carbon dioxide and then also to permanently sequester it. Now, when it comes to our abilities to, let's say, overshoot and come back down to 1.5 degrees Celsius, I feel, I have to say, that I have no confidence whatsoever that these current generations of carbon dioxide removal technologies are going to get us back to 1.5. And the reason I feel so confident about that is because the sheer amount of additional carbon we're going to put into the atmosphere through existing oil and gas and also coal, but then also the development of new oil and gas, so the continued financing of new oil and gas, the continued build of new oil rigs and infrastructure, we're going to put so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that it's going to dwarf anything like our abilities to remove it. And so if you go into that kind of time machine analogy again, if you think you can wind the clock back and somehow offset these many, many years of delay when it comes to actual reductions in emissions, our current abilities basically translate into perhaps a few seconds, maybe a few minutes, right? And really, we need to wind the clock back decades. And I just don't see any credible technology being able to do that in the time that we've got. It could be that at some point in the future, new tech emerges that will have some meaningful impact on concentrations. But by then, we'll be well past 1.5. So I just think the message has got to be warming very soon, long-term warming, will very soon pass 1.5 degrees Celsius. And there is no credible route back to safety.
The new paper in Nature raises several weighty problems that might delay actualization of mass-scale carbon dioxide removal. They include things like political resistance or failed business models. But then they say there could also be public opposition, and it's hard for me to picture that. Can you see public opposition to carbon capture and storage?
Many people think that scary technologies like solar radiation management, the spraying of sulfuric compounds into the atmosphere, they're scary, right? You can imagine there's going to be a lot of public resistance to these kind of technologies being deployed. But you would be mistaken to think there are no risks associated with carbon dioxide removal, because carbon dioxide, concentrated carbon dioxide, it's potentially lethal. It's an asphyxiant. You will suffocate if you are next to a pipeline which is transporting concentrated CO2 and it leaks. And as you probably know, the oil and gas industry has got a pretty checkered history when it comes to ensuring that its products don't leak out. So you've got the movement of millions, potentially billions, if they can get it to work, billions of tons of concentrated CO2 being piped around, being stored, and whilst it's not flammable, whilst it won't explode, it is silent, it is invisible, and if there were any kind of significant leaks in that infrastructure, you could see serious risks to public health. The other concerns that we've got with carbon dioxide removal could be some attempts to purposefully alter the chemistry in the ocean. There are also broader concerns with regards to its energy consumption. There was a plant in the United States that just recently was wanting to deploy a large-scale direct air capture plant, but we are told it was unable to do that because it could not secure sufficient supplies of green electricity. And, of course, there's no point running a direct air capture plant if it's going to be powered by electricity being generated by a coal-fired power station, right? So the current generation and possibly future generations of direct air capture are going to consume an awful lot of electricity. I mean, there are some estimates if it was going to have a meaningful impact on concentrations by the middle of this century, it could be eating up maybe a quarter of total global electricity supply. So these kind of things are not credible, but they might also mean they could crowd out other decarbonisation activities, right? So having a very energy-hungry process, whilst it might be well-intentioned, could actually prove to be counterproductive when you're desperately trying to decarbonise the rest of your society.
We have been speaking with Dr. James Dyke, Assistant Director of the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter in the UK. You can find links to follow up on all this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. Take time to notice joy when it comes. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about this world.
Banks that cook every living thing everywhere you look. Beam me up, Scotty, it's too hot down here. Daddy sold the planet and the atmosphere to go. The pressure cooker, super hot coil. Turn up the gas and burn that oil in the pressure cooker.
David Attenborough.
Standing here in the English countryside, it may not seem obvious, but we are facing a man-made disaster on a global scale. In the 20 years since I first started talking about the impact of climate change on our world, conditions have changed far faster than I ever imagined.
Before we started to burn coal, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was about 280 parts per million. It's now over 400 parts per million. And the planet gets warmer and warmer.
We are seeing the impacts of climate change now play out in real time. They're no longer subtle.
We're not just talking about an inconvenience. We're talking about people's lives, their livelihoods, and their communities being damaged.
Join the dots. It's happening. It's happening in your world. It's happening in my world. And let's be very clear about this. It is going to get much worse.
It may sound frightening, but the scientific evidence is that if we have not taken dramatic action within the next decade, we could face irreversible damage to the natural world and the collapse of our societies.
Never saw this. I never saw this. Nobody ever lived like this. Heat in winter, flood all of a sudden.